Good afternoon. We are going to have the second session of the day entitled Artists and the Transnational. The chair of this session will be artist Ricardo Basbaum, who just came from Rio de Janeiro. And Ricardo is need to find him first. An artist, curator, author, and editor of several publications on contemporary Brazilian art. He works in Rio de Janeiro. His work is presented at this moment in Documenta, so if you haven't seen it, you can look for it. He was co-director of the artist run space Agora and currently leads the Instituto de Artes at the University of the State of Rio de Janeiro, among other things he has done. The session will start with a paper by Moacir dos Anjos, who is a research fellow at the Fundação Joaquim Nabuco and former chief curator of Museu de Arte Moderna Aloísio Magalhães de Recife between 2001 and 2006. He was also on the curatorial coordination team for the Programa Itaú Cultural Artes Visuais. He's curated the next edition of the Panorama de Arte Brasileira, a very seminal exhibition in Brazil, which takes place at the Museum of Modern Art in São Paulo and is a kind of showcase of the current debates in Brazilian art. And he's also curator of the Brazilian submission for Arco next year in Madrid alongside Paulo Sergio Duarte. The second paper will be given by Deborah Cherry. Spatial Conversations will be an analysis of the work of Felix González Torres. And Deborah Cherry is Associate Director of TRAIN, Editor of Art History and Professor of the History of Art at Central St. Martin's College, Art and Design, in the University of the Arts, London. So I will leave you with Moacir dos Anjos. And please remember that we'll do questions and answers after each paper. And we will break after Milton Machado's presentation at 3 o'clock, which won't be a talk, it will be a presentation, like a performance. After that, we'll have a tea break and come back for the round table. Thank you.
Well, my presentation will be focused on some crucial aspects of the work of Brazilian artist Marepe, since it encompasses important issues associated with transnational correspondence in contemporary culture. Like several other artists working in different parts of the world today, Marepe manages to establish, from a particular position, symbolic transactions with those who possess other views regarding the world. He does so, however, without generating strict oppositions between distinct cultural formations. In fact, as you shall see, it is through his defense and affirmation of one location in the world, his native town, that Marepe makes it unique and at the same time close to any other place. In this way, Marepe contributes to the establishment of a poetics of diversity rather than a politics of difference. Marepe was born in Santo Antônio de Jesus, a town in the northeast of Brazil, almost 200 kilometers from Salvador, which is the capital city of Bahia. And Santo Antônio de Jesus is just under 1,900 inhabitants. Upon arriving in the town, one is greeted with large signs on the highway stating the local pride and vocation. Santo Antônio de Jesus, the cheapest commerce in Bahia. Whether or not this is true, it's certain that the town is economically and socially structured around the buying and selling of various goods and services, some of them formally organized and many others not. Numerous small shops and a few large ones line the streets and galleries of the town center, and spread over pavements, or even the roads themselves, stands and stalls offer anything ranging from houseware to food prepared on the spot, composing alongside the formal sales activities an urban texture that unites variety and disorder. Despite its almost humble size by Brazilian standards, and the fact that it is relatively distant from the region's metropolis, which is Salvador, The town is not cut off from everything that's far away, since the merchant nature of the activities brings an inbuilt opening to those outside and to that which is different. And Marep's work is founded precisely on the permeability to this simultaneously particular and extensive environment, strengthened by the transformations of a world that brings the near and the far ever closer together. Many of Marep's works from the mid-90s are testimonies of an interested and careful view of the activities that have long organized the common life of Santo Antônio de Jesus. After observing and photographing various street stalls, Marep remade some of them, making use of the same materials and techniques employed by whoever anonymously built some fowl on the streets. He then covered the replica stands with products identical to those sold on the original stands, even arranging them in a similar fashion. He colored them, for example, poison stand and jewelry stand. Not long before creating these works, he produced also the bundles made from the white clothes used for the transportation and storage of food for workers who spend the entire day away from their homes or otherwise for wrapping the content that is carried over the heads of those who work with the washing and iron of lining. Thus, he appropriates not the objects that exist in the town's confused web of activities, but only their images, respecting their use value and waving at the same time a praise of the forms of material existence of such objects, which are under constant threat of vanishing due to the dynamics of an economy of ever decreasing opportunities for those who are not large or otherwise associated with solid networks of interests. The description of these few pieces already allows one to recognize the artist's concern with bringing characteristic expressions from the space of his ordinary life into the encoded field of visual arts, where things are classified as sculptures, installations, objects, or similar denominations. Faced with the homogenizing power of global culture, Marep concerns himself with inserting into the very channels where this hegemony is claimed, that is, in art exhibitions, publications, amongst many others, channels, inserting in that channels that which belongs to his domestic territory, which he esteems and which hence inflates his potency to act. The artist's desire to protect a restricted and familiar space against something that supposedly denies it is therefore confused with the desire to occupy the more distant, yet wider, symbolic space that the artist establishes. The protections of that which he identifies as belonging to his place is not done by means of refusing that which distinguishes other territories. On the contrary, the objects, the landscapes, and the behaviors of everyday life of Santo Antônio de Jesus are presented in an amplified space through expressive forms created in traditions distinct to those present in the daily life of his hometown. The photographs that constitute the piece Sweet Santo Antônio Sky clearly unveils the ambiguous symbolic place to which they belong, to which the photograph belong, and of which they are furthermore witnesses. In the pictures, the artist, with his feet fixed firmly on the ground, seems to feed on the clouds that glide through the seed skies and that he reaches with an outstretched arm. As he eats, in fact, he can't floss. He associates this piece of the heavens that covers the community where he lives to the kind of protection generated only by childhood memories. He inserts this idea of closing it into the wide world, however, as the photographic documentation of a performance. In this process, he promotes not only the modification of a specific cultural system through another distinct one, but also the insertion into the field of art in which his work circulates, of ways of saying, seeing, and acting that were previously only present in the everyday life of Santo Antônio de Jesus. It so happens that just as between different linguistic systems, there is no univocal correspondence between different cultural systems. Consequently, there is no perfect transparency in that which is the result of these translations. Some single peak and therefore untranslatable always remains between the cultural formations placed at odds by the artist. Such opaqueness is proportional to the ignorance both of what common life in Marep's hometown consists of and of the concepts and codes that structure the field of high art. Therefore, if knowledge of the history and of the canonical procedures of contemporary visual production are not enough to unveil the possible meanings of his work, then the fact that the inhabitants of Santo Antônio de Jesus recognize the origin and function of each utensil, image, or gesture appropriated by the artist does not put them, for that reason, in a better position to understand his work. Before Marep's work, one seems to be always too far away or too close to that which supposedly could explain it in an accurate manner. His works actually represent strong evidence that the rubbing of differences produces not synthesis of identities, but rather hybrid and unstable affirmations of belonging, equally separated from the distinct elements from which they resulted, although always displaying traces of such elements. Coexisting this space of exchange that the contemporary world has instituted are therefore the defense and the sharing of territories, a defense formulated in an exemplary manner in the object entitled Acoustic Head. Made from two aluminum bowls like those used for washing clothes in modest households, a hinge that joins them like two halves of a clam, and a tapered baking tray resembling the shape of a speaker. For Marep, this work is protection from what is outside and a plunge into what is inside, a metaphor for the feeling of defense against the surroundings conjured up by his work. The voice of whoever wears this contraption and speaks from inside it, symbolically from a cultural territory that he or she wants to preserve, reverberates in the bowl's material, which shapes the sound, and reaches the ear of the other, that who is outside and listens to it. In a simple and playful way, the artist defends, to use Homi Bhabha's expression, defends the right to narrate the world based on points of view that simply by the fact of being emitted from diverse places possesses a particular accent and are never confused with other messages. Marep's work does not only comment on a place without an exact dimension, but also demarcates and inhabits such a territory, always demanding the other's imagination to inscribe meanings upon it, even if they are partial and provisional. And rarely has this appeal been so strong as when he transported a fragment from a wall in his hometown, 2 meters tall, 6 meters long, and weighing 3.5 tons, into the building hosting the São Paulo Biennial, almost 2,000 kilometers away. With this act, he transformed something which had a firmly established use for local residents into an open field for the exhibits visitors to exercise their dismay when faced with that which they could not definitely classify. Over this brick and cement wall is an advert painted in blue and yellow for an old and well-known convenience store of his town, Comercial São Luís, offering tudo no mesmo lugar pelo menor preço, everything the same place for the lowest price, confirming the desire to attract the other and to negotiate diverse merchandise. Displaced and deprived of its original utility, the first part of the slogan, everything in the same place, seems to recall how much the place, Santo Antônio de Jesus, amongst many other places, is imbued with everywhere. However, it could equally be read as a statement which was contradicted by the artist's action itself, since the displacement of the half wall would suggest that even supposedly fixed objects, such a wall, are not always in the same place, but on the contrary, in potential movement. The displacement of the wall from one seat to another sent the message, furthermore, that the global São Paulo, amongst many other places, depending on the place from which one observes the world, is also permeated by that which may seem peripheral and subordinated to it. Because the Santo Antônio de Jesus was also in São Paulo. On the other hand, if the emphasis is put on the last part of the slogan, for the lowest price, then one could read the painted phrase as an accident commentary on the symbolic and patrimonial value of works, evidently including his own. After they are inserted into or transported to supposedly important art exhibitions, where almost anything has a place. Finally, while they're all being transported around Brazil's highways, tied to the back of an open truck, and displaying the advert for the most important convenience store in Santo Antônio de Jesus, was certainly another demonstration of the artist's appreciation for his town and recognition of an inclination toward trade activities, it equally signified equating his affectionated relation to the town, here represented by the wall, to the idea of a place in permanent movement. This operation transformed Santo Antônio de Jesus from a territory with well-defined limits into a metaphor for a generic space of exchange between the near and the far. It was no longer merely a place of affection, but also became a concept. Nevertheless, Santo Antônio de Jesus is not to be idealized as a place of serene and peaceful harmony. Just as occurs in almost the whole country, in Brazil, daily life there is also marked by sharp social inequalities, and as a consequence, part of the population is denied access to basic public goods. Not by chance, housing has been a recurrent theme and an issue in Marep's work. In this regard, the work with embutidos, in built, stands out. This is almost a primitive house made from cheap ironware and wood that, caught somewhere between a prototype and an architectural model, reproduced building solutions invented by the poorest people in Brazil, faced with the chronic absence of houses. It's a representation of small dwellings, often far short of what is reasonable for living, but that displays a sophisticated understanding of space based on its ordinary usage. But although it expresses and celebrates the ability to adapt, displayed by a large portion of the Brazilian population faced with adverse circumstances, so well encapsulated in the term gambiarra, which translates in English for making do, this construction does not possess, precisely for that reason, only a positive connotation. It also expresses, in the symbolic field, Brazil's inability to implement a universal right, that is housing. It reproduces, nonetheless, survival tactics that the artist considers worthy of symbolic permanence by means of their being transported and translated into the sphere of high art, granting wide visibility to that which many hardly even notice in the rush of everyday life. Once again, the ambiguous nature of the place of affection is evident in Marep's work, where one finds undivided some impulses that enthuse them and others that sadden him. Enthused him and others that sadden him. The house, or lack of it, is equally present in the sculpture made The Roof, in which the dwelling is a cover made of wooden clay tiles laid directly on the empty floor, or in the piece called The Door and Window, in which the house is reduced, as indicated in the title, to a wooden door and a window lent on any place, giving access to nowhere or else to a space which exists only in the dimension of hope or yearning. Again, both these works, through the evident absence of all the rest, affirm the problems of lack of housing accessible to a significant portion of the Brazilian population, leading many to migrate with their few belongings in search of better conditions that are not always found. This forced and arduous mobility is presented with bitter humor in The Move, a lorry made entirely of wood to a scale somewhere between that of a toy and an identical reproduction, which obviously does not move, and is loaded with domestic items made from the same material, include ones like a cooker or fridge that obviously do not work. The affirmation of the local in Marep's work is not then merely laudatory. Alongside the celebration of the roots, views, and manual abilities of the region that he judged to be in need of defense against the homogenizing power of global culture, the artist also exposed the inequalities that permeate and shape his place of origin, and that must, as he makes clear, be fought and changed. After all, if a three and a half ton wall was carried almost 2,000 kilometers, a wooden lorry can travel even further. Throughout his whole career, Marep has defended the symbolic place where he feels at home, which he knows so well, and that increases his power to act. Yet, without refusing contact with the distant and estranged place of the other, which, by threatening the integrity of his beloved territory, in principle weakens his strength to exist. Indeed, many of his pieces affirm that only by means of promoting proximity between these places will it be possible, in a world of progressively dissolving frontiers, to imagine and construct new forms of belonging. Refusing nostalgia for the sake of an atemporal sense of identity, and in equal measure, refusing to surrender to ways of life to which he can only fully relate, Marep invokes a symbolic space of flexible borders, which is in constant construction, necessarily interwoven with negotiations, conflicts, and agreements of an uncertain duration. It's not a matter of establishing blind opposition between different geographical and cultural formations, but rather one of absorbing, translating, and launching onto the appropriate circuits of diffusion the often contradictory effects of this inevitable neighboring relation. To achieve this aim, his work constantly frustrates the expectations of those who only look to recognize in it a praise of the past and the peripheral, in supposed dual opposition to a present time and a central territory, where the former would evoke a life attached to particular ways of life, and the latter, adhesion to a generic international art. In numerous different ways, the artist constructs ties of or proposes possible associations between the defense of the vernacular and the desire for the cosmopolitan, between that which comforts and that which brings suffering, between that which is necessary to survival and that which is just a representation of something. He therefore established a space of dissent amidst conventional concepts and ideas that ignore the complex forms of identity present in the contemporary world, asking whoever enters in contact with his works to negotiate and question the meanings they may bring. A space of dissent that is also the draft for a new and incomplete cartography of a world that powerfully unites Santo Antônio de Jesus with so many other places that share with Marep's town the uncertainty of the feelings experienced in everyday life and in the extended field of art. Thank you.
Thank you, Monsieur, for your presentation. Maybe it's interesting to tell the audience that in Brazil, we also reproduce, more or less, in the territory of the country, this imbalance of having in the whole country certain cities that are more powerful centers, economic centers, so they attract the artists or to the cities. So it's a kind of internal in the country situation that is more or less reproduced in the world. In this, let's say, we have also centers of powers in the world that attract attention, that are kind of broken under this globalizing situation that in terms of the own territory of the country, also Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo, because they are economic centers, they play a role of attracting people there. And it's interesting that Marep, although he works with in relation with the centers of power, he refuses to move from the city where he lives, and he keeps working there. And I think from your presentation, it's really interesting how he keeps working on his place where he really, he's from that place, there his cultural relations, he feels at home. But at the same time, he understands, let's say, this international language of the white cube somehow. My question to you is, how you see, let's say, in terms of his work, a kind of conflict, or even sometimes they go together, of more formal aspects of his work that we can more or less see in relation of history of art, or even the history of Brazilian art, and some anthropological aspects, and how this, let's say, international standards of the white cube, how they filter also some aspects that come from more close to, let's say, anthropological information of his work, and also pointing this, let's say, going one direction and also back, as someone pointed in the first half of the conversation. Let's say he takes things from the city into this international system of art, so they just move everywhere, and how these things return to that city, if they may return or not. I mean, if this information also gives a feedback back to this place.
There are two different questions. As the first one, I think that Marais comes from the generation of Brazilian artists, which made for the first time the generation which start his work, start their careers in Brazil, and at the same time are attracted to the global or international art world. In that sense, Marep, and at the same, it's interesting that in the early 90s, when Marep starts his work, it was clear for the Brazilian young Brazilian artists that they were part of a tradition, an internal tradition, made of anthropophagy and neoconcretismo, and even because of the international international show of the Eliotzik, international shows of Eliotzik, Ligia Clark, and other artists, Hildo Meirelles, it was clear for the Brazilians as well that was a national tradition. There was a genealogy to which they belonged to. But at the same time, and also because of that that affirmation of this tradition, there was the international art world, the international art market, attracted these artists to make exhibitions and to take part of the residences and publications, which made them feel that they also belonged to other traditions. So I think that is very clear in Marep's works. He is always negotiating between his own traditions, besides his hometown, symbolic, the activities and the landscapes and the reeds and all these things related to his hometown. He also relates to the internal genealogy, which go back to anthropophagy and neoconcretism, but also at the same time with other things that were occurring all over the world. So his work is one of the translation. All the time he's translating things into one thing into the other, one form into the others. And that's the first part of the question. And as the second one, I think that there's almost no feedback in terms of these other worlds, the world that where Marep's work is showed, and back to his hometown. There is an untranslability of what happens outside there when it's shown. Marep is almost an unknown person in his hometown.
A kind of foreigner in his own.
Yeah, but even so, he feels very much attached to it. He feels at home only there.
Well, I think now it's open for questions.
Thank you. I suppose I'm just curious about Marab as an artist, and I'm curious, being an artist myself, do you think that, you know, the kind of invisibility that he occupies as an artist in that kind of category in his hometown is something that he enjoys? I mean, I don't know.
No.
He doesn't. And why?
Because, in a sense, he's praising the things that happens in his town. I'm saying it's not present in his work, but I know that he would like very much to be recognized, and that people would recognize his city, their city, in his work. But as there are no galleries, art galleries in his town, there are no ways of showing, of exhibiting his work in Santo Antônio de Jesus, like in most parts of small to middle cities in Brazil.
Do you think the nature of his practice would shift? I know it's a kind of unknown quantity, but do you think the nature of his practice would shift were it to be different? Well, if the kind of anonymity of his being, if you like, was discovered, or, you know, I'm just curious as an artist, you know, about that.
I don't know. What I know is that is something that sometimes he's afraid of changing the nature of his work if he moved from his seat.
I'm aware I'm jumping the queue, but it's related. I'd just like to ask a few questions. I mean, this was obviously an edited version of your essay in the book. But in the book, you mention popular festivities where Marepi participates in what you describe as performance, mm-hmm. a kind of collective performances. And doesn't that contradict the you mentioned that there are not galleries, but the fact that he's offering these performances, and isn't that a kind of recognition?
It's a recognition, but the inhabitants of the city do not recognize him as an artist, but someone who is part of a community who is sharing with them, with other members of this community, some sort of actions, collective actions, organizing and distributing goods for these children, and so on. But not in the circuit, in the art circuit. It's a different sort of recognition. There is even, I've got a video of one of these performances. If you have time later on, you can show, if you wish so, when he distributes candy glasses for the children during a festivity in his city.
I think it's interesting on this topic of his local city and the world, let's say the international art system where he really practices his work. Is that how this structure somehow filters many aspects of what we consider his artwork? I mean, so in this shifting, in this displacement, we can get something from his work, and other things really disappear. And so emphasizing maybe aspects that are not retained by this, we could somehow...
That's why the title of the presentation is that we're always close or too far away from his works. It's almost entranced between one and the other world.
There's a question there.
Hi. I'm asking for both of you, Ricardo and Moacir, that you are talking about this international projection about Marape and the other artists. And in the morning, we heard about Oriana's speech about that transnational production. And we were just thinking at lunch about the aesthetics, that Marape has very cultural aesthetics in his work, like in that work called Embutidos. It reminds me of a work from Henrique Oliveira, that's another very young artist from Brazil, who used the same material that has this... I don't know if I can say this, Brazilian aesthetics. And my question is if in this transnational production that Oriana was talking earlier, which aesthetics do you think we can define in this transnational production for the new artists? Like, I don't know, in Marape we can really identify these Brazilian themes and things more like Basbal is has a work in Documenta that I can't, that's very global with a lot of part of the world.
I think that you are not, we need to be, if I understood your question, I need to be aware of not in essentializing what is Brazilian in the work of Brazilian artists. I think that we should, it's more productive to think in terms of a method, or think that the Brazilian artists, at least the generation of Marape and the others, and which arise in the last years, are all the time negotiating between different genealogies, and in this way making it transnational all the time. But I wouldn't think in terms of aesthetics, in terms of format, trying to identify formal aspects, dominant aspects of this production, because in this sense we would be end up essentializing an idea of Brazilianness. But maybe Oriana could add something on that.
Yeah, maybe this is a topic that will come in the round table
Certainly,
discussion.
Yeah.
Authenticity was in relation to Marape's work, because he's very witty in the way in which he plays between different notions of what is a found object, what is a made, you know, what is made, what is found, what is the popular, what is the art of the Biennale. And I think it's quite a self-conscious knowingness that he plays with in relation to, you know, Brazilianness and regionalness, communityness. I thought it would be fascinating to look at that last image you showed with in relation to Thomas de Mand. Actually, it was the play on what is real and what isn't real is something that is a very international issue, a transnational issue, and not just a Brazilian one. Yet he makes fun of that through the handmade nature of the existence of poverty that he's laying claim to with the thing. So it's not really an answer. It's just it's a comment, because I just think it was a really interesting set of themes to explore.
Well, I think we need to continue to come to the next presentation because of the time, and then this discussion will continue with the roundtable.
I'd just like to start with a big thank you to Michael for organising a really wonderful conference, and to say what a real privilege it is to be here on a platform today with such interesting and lively presentations. The works reach out and recede, ebb and flow. They enter into conversation with viewers who wonder whether to reach out and touch, even take away. They enter into conversations with other works of art, especially floor pieces, stored in museums, in studios, in warehouses, in the memories of spectators, curators, and artists. The candy spills of Felix González Torres come into being and into meaning in an ebb and flow between those who take and those who remake, those who regard and those who touch, those who keep their distance, and those who come up close. Shown in international exhibitions, most notably at this year's Venice Biennale, what meanings might the candy spills of this artist have for today's transnational audiences, for a new century preoccupied with questions of mobility and migration and characterized by cultural flows and encounters. Born in Cuba in 1957, the artist grew up in Puerto Rico. He migrated to the United States of America, where he lived, studied, and worked for the rest of his life. He became an American citizen in 1976. In undertaking a journey made by so many from countries so close to and yet so far from the United States, the artist made a crossing into a different culture and into another language. Writing an obituary for publication in Art Forum in the US soon after the artist's death in 1996, Gerardo Mosquera lamented the expected translation of the artist's name by the editors of Art Forum. Felix with an accent on the E, Gonzalez with an accent on the A, Torres, became translated into Felix Gonzalez Torres, without accents and with a hyphen between the Gonzalez and the Torres. In this short piece, Remember My Name, Mosquera dwelt on the Latino-ness of the artist's work, linking it to the practices of artists such as Otisica, now showcased here at Tate, and our excuse indeed for being here today, perhaps. Mosquera would have been well aware of the artist's outspoken refutation of any Latino identity in an interview with Tim Rollins in 1993. In response to Rollins's comment that, I've heard a lot of grumbling, Felix, about the lack of an overt political or Latino content in your work, the artist replied, laughing, well, I just want to start by saying that the maracas sculptures are next. I'm not a good token. I don't wear the right colors. I have my own agenda. Some people want to promote multiculturalism as long as they are the promoters, the circus directors. We have an assigned role that's very specific, very limited. As in a glass vitrine, we, the other, have to accomplish ritual, exotic performances to satisfy the needs of the majority. This parody is becoming boring very quickly. Who is going to define my culture? It's not just Borges and Garcia Marquez. It's also Gertrude Stein and Freud and Debord. They're all part of my formation. In this response, the artist firmly refutes any desires for authenticity that are made of artists who seem to be demonstrably migrant. Mosquera's reflection of this question of Latino identity and the focus on the artist's name without accents and with a hyphen points out some of the ways in which the artist came to be absorbed into and identified as a US North American artist. At Venice, of course, as some of you may well know, the selection of the work of Felix Gonzalez Torres, along with the statements by the curator Nancy Spector, emphasized the artist as a commentator on the United States of America. This is an artist relevant for the United States today. The selection includes works which seem to suggest this relevance, untitled Republican Years, Memorial Day Weekend and Veterans Day Sale are all paper stacks shown there. This is a work from the Guggenheim, Untitled America, Untitled Public Opinion, a candy spill in which licorice is laid out on the floor. And the curator, Nancy Spector, has been reported as saying that the artist would probably have considered his art to be even more relevant politically now than when he made it, with the war in Iraq and domestic battles raging over government eavesdropping, gay marriage, and the concentration of wealth in America. Indeed, the artist did comment critically on the society to which he relocated. Favorably received in the US, his work also met an enthusiastic reception in Europe. It was widely displayed and collected by museums, galleries, and private collectors. Yet the recent presentation in Venice frames the work within a specific geopolitical and national relevance. In a contemporary transnational world, national units are, however, increasingly under pressure and scrutiny. In a forthcoming essay, Claire Harris elucidates the way in which, I quote, bounded conceptions of culture based on nationality or ethnicity will not suffice in a transnational era when artists and their works are so highly mobile. She explores the ways in which people and acts, art and artists, are subject to influences beyond the places they inhabit. These are multiple sites, shaped by global cultural flows as much as local conditions. Moreover, and central to my argument here, Claire Harris emphasizes that one place transfers into and is not forgotten by the next place. As she puts it, I quote, "The cultural logic of one place is not erased by departure from it. Rather, that place remains as a memory which can be deployed in an artistic practice, which is," she says, I quote again, "the cumulative impact of multiple locations." I want to say here that González Torres was a transnational subject, a person caught within the cultural flows of a world shaped by migration, including his own. And I want to think about his art in terms of a transnational practice, shaped not only by transnational multiple locations, but by sense memories which may transport across these different places. The artist, as is well known, was a varied, inventive, and experimental artist with a vast array of work in a short life. Beaded curtains, billboards, light pieces and strings, candy stacks, paper stacks, portraits, and other works. The candy spills are clustered within a short period, 3 or 4 years, from around 1991 to around 1993. And they come in various different versions. Single colours, like carpets, they can be multicolours and piled up in little stacks and spills. There can be single colours of the wrappings, multicolours, as here, blue placebo on the left and a portrait of Ross in LA on the right. They can be spilled against a corner, against a wall, or scattered on the floor. Some installations allow you to walk round all four sides if the carpet is scattered on a floor. Some allow just a critical edge which you come up to and perceive. These works, I think, can be often installed in different ways too. This is the same piece, but installed as a flat carpet-like piece or just in a little mound beside a wall. This is Placebo Landscape for Roni in two different installations. The candy spills, I think, are sensory works. They often involve touching or lying down in them if you're small enough. The two images at the top and on your left-hand side were taken at a particular show at the Hamburger Bahnhof, particularly to show people interacting. And the one with the little baby is from a Chicago piece, a travelling exhibition. To interact with them, most mobile adult viewers and older children will bend down, dip towards the work, kneel on the floor, shifting focus, perception and perspective. The candy pieces may provoke participation, but they also offer, I think, a variety of kinds of interaction. Participation is much spoken about now, but also there are different kinds of sensory sensations which are engaged by these works, which also bring characteristic sensory experience. Sensory experiences often take place whether we want them or not. We may be assailed by a smell without deliberately seeking it. Sensory experiences are often available after they have happened, rather than before. They are illusory, momentary, transient, and often they will provoke very sharp memories. The reminder of a scent, the reminder of something that we heard, will then provoke a set of memories which come like chains associated with them. In the gallery, the colours which enchant the eyes are the actual visual pleasures of these works. Can be accompanied by myriad sounds, twists of paper, rustles of bodily movement, whispers of consultation, shall we or shan't we? There is, for those who take them, the silken touch of the wrappings, the sweet saccharine taste of the candies. Often there's a little secret message hidden under the wrapping, so there's a double kind of touch there. Their sensory affects may come all together or one by one. We could delay opening the sweet paper, defer the anticipated pleasures, or never open it at all, just look at it and enjoy it as a little tiny object. Sensory responses to a work of art can also be extraordinarily diverse, and they are not shared by visitors in equal capacity. Sensory responses, too, change over time. The candies can encourage, therefore, sensory experiences, but also sense memories. They may recall childhood experiences and desires, perhaps never fulfilled to quite this degree, a satiety of sweetness, a sensory débordement. And the work can offer also memories that might tease us, conjure sensory responses, or perhaps memories of them. Many commentators on the work of Félix González Torres, These Little Candy Spills, have thought of them as conjuring heady, guilty pleasures for adults, recollections of pleasurable childhood moments. But the candy spills could equally provoke a sensory disgust, a distaste for all this sweetness, a sense of nausea as much social as somatic, a sensory and physical revulsion triggered by this glut of sugariness. It's not a question, I think, of whether there is or isn't a sensory response to the work, nor is it a question of the authenticity or simulacra of sensory provocations projected by the art or the artist. There isn't either authenticity or simulacra, or active participation, or more distant viewing. I think there's a lot of different things going on here, an interaction between potential corporal activities and sensory activities and responses. Memory has been central to the interpretation of this work. Russell Ferguson has invoked the most famous memory moment, that of Proust, thinking about the Madeleine dipped in tea, which then begins to unravel the memories encoded in his most famous novels. Memory, which can be personal and collective, is seen by commentators to complete the work and to link our responses to it, to social engagement and social responsibility. But there is, I think, a little more, something to do with the kind of sensory responses, sensory experiences, which these works might provoke. As artworks circulate through global exhibitions, they address differentiated audiences, bodies, and sensory regimes. They call into question not only art's intelligibility and its translatability across all these different places, but also its sensory impact and the responses that different audiences might have. In The Skin of the Film, Laura Marx, writing in 2000, proposes a theory of intercultural cinema which interrogates sensory experience and sense memories. She explores haptic forms of viewing, the ways that these are engaged by artists that work and deal with the experiences of being, living, and moving between different cultures. Laura Marx emphasizes the importance of sense memories for artists, curators, and theorists in thinking about making and interpreting work. She argues that works of art may activate sense memories deliberately or unconsciously. The senses, she says, are important forms of transmission between cultures, between and across cultures, although, as she is aware, potential meanings may or may not migrate. There is, she thinks, an equal potential for unintelligibility, for sense meanings, memories, and associations to be lost in translation, to transmit partially or in unexpected or surprising ways. Sense memories are, I think, packed into the industrialized manufacture of these candies, as well as the global circulation of their raw materials, notably sugar, from which they are made. Like the artist himself, these goods and materials may be understood within Claire Harris's argument for the cumulative impact of multiple locations, and the idea that she's proposed, that the cultural logic of one place is not erased on departure from it. These candies are transnational commodities, and this artist, I think, made his work within a transnational experience, subject to the influence of places well beyond those that he inhabited in living and working in the USA. The artist spent his early years on two very different islands of the Caribbean East Antilles, both of which came out of Spanish rule in the 1898 Spanish-American War. One, Puerto Rico, has become an Estado Libre Asociado with close affiliation to the United States as a Commonwealth. And for some interpreters, it is the longest-standing colony of the USA. Cuba, as is well known, has been a socialist republic from 59, with its allegiance until 89 to Russia and China. Both islands have been major sugar producers, and their histories, societies, landscapes, and populations have been shaped by this product, as have their later histories and legacies. Both islands, too, in the 20th century, have diversified from being major sugar producers to become tourist resorts and also to be heavily involved in the production of pharmaceuticals. Sugar, pharmaceuticals, and people have moved from these two Caribbean islands, taking sense memories with them. In a small number of artworks by the artist, the alliance of sugar and pharmaceuticals is hinted at in the titles that the artist very carefully chose for his works, and he always had a very particular format of untitled. Every work is untitled, and then a subtitle, which kind of worked as a supplement to add to and displace the work of the untitled. This is Untitled Blue Placebo and Untitled Placebo Landscape for Roni again. These titles, but also the little sweets themselves in other works, link the little bonbons to medicinal placebos used in drug trials, organized for the development of cures and antidotes for AIDS. Bordered by these titles, the sweet spills conjure perhaps not so much sensory delight and gratification, but pain, loss, grief, sickness, nausea, even horror. Charles Merriweather has likened these little sweets to Derrida's pharmacon, remedy and poison. If the most spoken association, often in the artist's interviews, is to the illness and death of his partner, Ross Laycock, the embedded memories, I want to suggest, point to the major industries that have shaped the history of the Caribbean and its relation particularly to North America. This little sensory sign, then, of the wrapped sweet carries sweet memories, perhaps. It is imprinted also with social memories and historical relations embedded in the present, memories carried along the trading links and born in the migrational patterns of modernity from Spain to the Americas, from Africa to the Caribbean, across the Antilles, and then further north to the US. The sugary thing, as the artist have called it, these little sweets that he used, is redolent of colonial and neo-colonial trades in people, materials, and goods. The candy spills often conjure metaphors of the sea, their edges ebbing and flowing like the water's edge, their surfaces rippling and glinting like gentle waves. This little sweet, chosen by the artist, offers its sensory pleasures and its memories. We may say that its art touches us, that its meanings are embedded, even embodied, if we eat the sweet. Yet the sweet dissolves and its meanings diffuse. They resist capture and the certainty that the work's sensory affect will have any further effect. Will the plenitude of sense memories embodied in the candy spills linger in time to produce further action? Sense memories are, after all, unpredictable, volatile in transmission and translation. Whether this work touches us, I think, depends on the sensory associations and memories that the work triggers, and that we, each one of us, in all our difference and diversity, bring to it and take away. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. It's really interesting what you spoke about. I think it's not easy, really, to organize some particular questions, because I think you show how this relation of culture and politics and this, let's say, international language of art can be really interconnected in a not really simple way. It's interesting how you showed that the artist, Félix González Torres, refused to be labeled easily in terms of one only one cultural reference or even one cultural nationality. And you even spoke about him as being a sort of transnational subject. So my question will be really basic in terms of asking you, because it's clear that the cultural and the political lines, they don't match. And in the end, how this artist, Félix González Torres, he became labeled as a North American artist, in the sense that all the discussion of his work was organized there by the circuit, North American circuit, and all the knowledge they have and all the tools they have. So my question will be sort of, in the end, it's like this, this cultural discussion is very much under certain, let's say, political pressure, and how, let's say, since modern art, there is a kind of international search for breaking certain boundaries, but how in the end we all the time have need to be aware that actually the boundaries are, they don't disappear completely and they are always rooted somewhere. So my question is about this kind of breaking some barriers and try to organize in the flows in terms of memory and in terms of sensorial experience, and how they somehow they sometimes return to certain political closures. I just would like to hear you about this.
I was trying to think, when we were presented with the project of this conference, it prompted me to think about the different ways in which a subject like this artist, who did migrate from one place to another and then decided to definitely settle in America, what that might mean in terms of of how he might develop as an artist. So I was thinking about that track, and also because of the recent work that's been done to bring him into this very much a North American US circuit at Venice. And as you say, that's where so much of the knowledge of the artist has been produced. So I wanted to begin to think about what happened if we didn't think about him and didn't think about his work within those frameworks. It was just, in a way, it's quite an experimental way of thinking outside the more normal ways of thinking about this artist, without thinking about that particular national label on it, on his work that seems to have been particularly recently come to coincide with his work. So we're trying to think about that, and also to think about the ways in which, as work circulates in different international, transnational circuits, it's seen by subjects who come with all sorts of different memories to it, so that the relationship between the spectator and the work will produce all sorts of often unspoken or not officially spoken responses to the work, even in that particular international circuit. So we're also trying to, as you say, to kind of bring a sense of these flows and migrations to the interpretation of the work, rather than to see it as completely transnationalized and only speaking to a rather monocultural, international audience. So it's a bit experimental, and I'm not quite sure if it works, but I wanted to try out and see if it did work.
Any questions?
I was curious as to why all the photographs of the works that you showed, I think, showed them in their untouched original shape, perhaps, and none of them showed the objects after people had taken sweets away. And I don't know if that was simply accidental, but it made me, looking at those images, aware only of their sort of formal relationships to American minimalism, and even corner works like Joseph Beuys's Fat Corner and so on. Could that be because there was in moments that were chosen to photograph, there was a sort of lingering feeling of this sort of art object, a finished and complete autonomous object?
I think a lot of the photographs do tend to show the work in its kind of pristine state, or they tend to show very staged moments of spectators bending down in very particular ways, very aware of the camera. But there are, I mean, there are some photographs of when he did a work with aquamarine candies at the Renaissance Society in Chicago, which I didn't see, but there are a suite of photographs there of people were allowed to walk through the work, and as people walked through the work, the work dispersed, and so what had started off as being a fairly uniform carpet, if you like, got all cut up and cut into, and the bonbons just went all over the place. But I think there is a tendency in photography, at least, to preserve this unique, special, first display.
You didn't have any input into the way his works were photographed, as far as you know.
I don't know. Perhaps other people do. I mean, at the moment, I mean, of course, the legacy is maintained by the foundation, and so. The foundation, who came out of the artist gallery, tend to have a very particular set of images about the artist's work.
Mm. Thanks.
There's a question
here. Hi, I was just wondering if you think that maybe his homosexuality had maybe more to do with his sort of transnationalized position than his practice, just because, I mean, I think many gays around the world either nationally have to very often move to a bigger city and from your hometown, or if you can do, move internationally. And then I do think that lesbian gays start feeling part of a sort of international community, and that becomes a much more important issue than your nationality. And I was wondering, I often feel that about his work quite a lot.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I do think that's the case, and also that, I mean, in the interviews that he gave when he was live, because he talked a lot about Ross, his partner, and he made works very specifically in relation to Ross's illness, his terminal decline, and his death. I think that also has a, you know, there's a lot of importance there about AIDS being a global crisis. I mean, that wasn't something that was very publicly hitting North American society, but it was and still is a really globally urgent issue. So I think that also, those two things, you're right, they feed together. But I would also, you know, it's very difficult to, we want to be a little cautious too about how we put biography and art together, you know, and how we see that. And also, like you say, the question of the audience for that. But no, I think that's really, really interesting and important.
So, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Deborah.
Thank you for your question.
We continue with Milton Machado.
I have to apologize to Milton for overseeing his description as an artist, an architect. So I want to introduce him as an architect, artist, and writer who lives and works in Rio de Janeiro. He's associate professor for the Art History and Theory Department and the Visual Arts Postgraduate Program at the Rio de Janeiro Federal University School of Fine Arts. He holds a PhD in Fine Arts from Goldsmiths College, University of London, and he's also a researcher for the CNPq, Brazilian National Research Center. And I leave you with Milton Machado. Thank you.
Well, it's not exactly as has been announced. I'm not going to do a performance, although there will be some kind of performance in the back. Also, I don't know yet, I have to decide in the next 10 minutes, if I will present to you both parts of this presentation. I'll have to decide that. But anyway, if I decide to present the both parts, I'll say some words about them. The first piece, which is an introduction to the second, tries to deal with a question that has been directed to all of us who took part in this publication, which goes like this. To what extent would you consider your practice as an artist, curator, writer, academic, to be informed by place, a term that implies both the institution and its attendant histories and traditions and geopolitical location. So this is the question I'm trying to cope with in the first part. And the second part is something that has been prepared, written, to go in a folder that went with an exhibition that has to do with the images we'll be seeing very soon. And I will introduce you to this second problem very soon. So I'm trying to respond to this question, saying I might be a practicing artist, a curator, a writer, and an academic. But am I all these things at the very same time, and all in the very same place? Can I be an artist in the morning, a curator at lunchtime, a writer in the evening, and an academic when I'm in bed, sleeping? My answers will depart necessarily from a delayed, postponed, dislocated, out-of-place place. I cannot but attempt to find answers to these questions on the move. So the first part of the paper is called Poor, to which I found the following definitions in my dictionary and thesaurus in my personal computer. From the dictionary, it says, poor, one, it's a noun, chiefly from biology, a minute opening inner surface, like the skin or integument of an organism through which gases, liquids, or microscopic particles can pass. Origin, late Middle English, from Old French via Latin, from Greek, poros, passage, pore. Pore to, verb, intransitive, pore over, pore through. Be absorbed in the reading or study of. Example, Heather spent hours poring over cookbooks. Archaic, think intently, ponder. Example, when he has thought and poured on it. Origin, Middle English, perhaps related to beer. From the thesaurus, pore one, noun. Pores in the skin, opening, orifice, aperture, hole, outlet, inlet, vent. Pore two, verb, they poured over the map, study, read intently, peruse, scrutinize, scan, examine, go over. Okay, so I'm reading Poor to you now. I'll repeat the question, yeah? So that you can remember what I'm talking about. To what extent would you consider your practice as an artist, curator, writer, academic, to be informed by place? An initial clarification is due. Of which place are we talking? And it would be necessary to modulate this question. Are we talking as regards a determinate place, or are we talking as from a determinate place? Or of some determinate place that a determined utterance intends to determine? Are we talking of ends or of principles, or objectives or of purposes, of mine or of yours? The place of which one talks conditions that which is said about any place, even about that place from where one is talking. Likewise, the person who's talking and to whom he or she is talking. The words of an immigrant, of an exile, of a foreign tourist, an alien, are distinct from those of a native, of the place about which and from which both may at some point be talking. Even if in virtue of some principle or purpose, they seem to be talking in the same language. The accent is a kind of modulation, in terms of both accentuation and setting. In Portuguese, we have two words which are similar. They play a kind of différence trick. One is acento, and the other one is acento. They sound the same, but acento with a C means accent, and acento with a double S means seat. So the accent is a kind of modulation. Of location, of local or dislocated action, with a higher of, or lower degree of comfort for he who speaks and for he whom is spoken to. Another modulation is this. It is problematic to delimit the place one is talking of. be it as an end, a principle, an objective, or a purpose. The person that is talking and the person to whom one is talking condition the place of the place relative to which and from which one is talking, as well as the manner in which one talks. In Brazil, phrases such as, do you know who you're talking to, and watch how you talk, are expressions of well-defined, highly authoritative principles and purposes. Like Robert De Niro's line in Taxi Driver, armed to the teeth and aiming at himself in the mirror, are you fucking talking to me? Expressing modulations between authority, impotence, and folly. So many modulations with which I could carry on playing, testing our patience until exhaustion. That was precisely my intention, are likely to lead us to a limit, to a module in itself. This bordering and initial module, I propose, would be the body itself. Our own body would be the place about which and from which everything is, of which everything comes to be a modulation. But if indeed this is so, how could we talk of our own body without applying straight off an initial and radical modulation, extension or reduction of the body itself that is I? And furthermore, or less, would be appropriate to talk of a body that is not, before, after, a property of the spirit, in which every modulation, every measure, every consideration loses its meaning. Between property and appropriation, there should be this word. Of which body are we talking? Of the body that asks questions, makes requests, gives presents, or of that same body that answers, refuses, and gives in return? Of mine or of yours, themselves? Of the touch of the first caress that raises goose pimples, or of the cut from a fencing bout, from the final strike worthy of a touche? Are we talking of powers, superpowers, or of disempowerment? Do you know who you're talking to? Are you fucking talking to me? Some modulations of the proper are improper. The point of the place, not always, is pointless. The purpose of the place, not always, is purposeless. The place of the place, not always, is out of place. The images you're seeing are from this performance, in Portuguese, Homem Muito Abrangente, in English, Very Extensive Man. Something I did with Roger. This is Roger, who is a very good knife thrower. But he is playing the role of a very bad knife thrower, because the good knife thrower is supposed to aim outside the figure. So he's really making many mistakes because he's kind of killing himself. Well, since I said something about Roger, I'll say something about this very extensive man. A man so extensive as to occupy the whole world apart from the space of his own body could do very well as the assistant to a bad knife thrower. I repeat, because it's kind of tricky, yeah? A man so extensive as to occupy the whole world apart from the space of his own body could do very well as the assistant to a bad knife thrower. There are other things I would like to say about very extensive men. So extensive that his coverage is almost total. But he's lacking something of himself. He searches for himself, but always in vain. The very extensive man occupies all the voids. And nevertheless, he cannot return. His loss is of origin, an origin so extensive that nothing within it is final. It has been said that his end is not an end in itself. Like every respectable man to whom Pico della Mirandola dedicated an oration, there is something of the chameleon about him. He lacks individuality. He has no one single vocation, nor one single appearance. He seems as it seems, unique yet plural. He may be all things, doing everything he wishes. However, he is denied one single occupation, his own. His only property is not having anything of his own, above all, anything internal. And so he's a hybrid, impure. always beyond the limits the very extensive man is the purest exteriority. I think I will go into the second part, which is, as I said, something I wrote for the catalog that went with this exhibition, and it's called This Body is All Pores, which actually is the conversation between some very interesting people. And these people are David, Donald, Leonardo, Pico, Pliny, John, Mark, and Gaber, KT, and the assistant. I am the assistant. David Harvey is a geographer. Donald Lowe is a historian. Leonardo da Vinci is an artist. Pico della Mirandola is a humanist. Pliny the Elder is a naturalist. John Johannes Kepler is an astronomer. Mark Marcus Vitruvius is an architect. And Gaber Daniel Hotel is a good knife thrower. KT is a bad knife thrower, and I am the assistant. I am a good assistant to the bad knife thrower. This was a meeting that took place in Rio at the National Circus School in February 2006. Assistant. But in view of this almost entire absence of a body, of this almost absolute impossibility of falling into oneself, how can one think, like the ancient Greeks, like the Renaissance humanists, that the body is the measure of all things? Donald. It's true that instability of reference is a contemporary condition. You yourself have already said that perplexity would be our only historic certainty. However, there still remains one referent apart from all the other destabilized referents, whose presence cannot be denied, and this is the body referent, our very own live body. This body referent is, in fact, the referent of all reference, in the sense that ultimately all signifies, values, and or meanings refer to the delineation and satisfaction of the needs of the body. Precisely because all other referents are now destabilized, the body referent, our own body, has emerged as a problem. And so we have the impression that this body that is there is out there absent. David Harvey. It really does seem problematic to maintain the idea that the body is the measure of all things. But I would have two propositions to make in order to help equate the problem. The first is that the body is an unfinished project, historically and geographically malleable in certain ways. The body is not a closed and sealed entity, but a relational thing that is created, bounded, sustained, and ultimately dissolved in a spatial-temporal flux of multiple processes. It can be said that the body is, if it can be said that the body is a thing. The body, construed as a thing-like entity, internalizes the effects of the processes that create, support, sustain, and dissolve it. The body which we inhabit and which is for us the irreducible measure of all things is not itself irreducible. This is not to view the body as a passive product of external processes. What is remarkable about living entities is the way they capture diffuse energy or information flows and assemble them into complex but well-ordered forms. Creating order out of chaos is a vital property of biological systems. As a desiring machine capable of creating order, not only within itself, but also in its environs, the human body is active and transformative in relation to the processes that produce, sustain, and dissolve it. Assistant, perhaps this helps us understand the anatomy of this body that is so extensive, and first to understand its peculiar dermatology, the logic of its surface. For after all, this body is full of holes, pierced. This body is all pores. David Harvey, well said. To conceptualize the body, the individual and the self, as bestowed with this porosity of which you speak in relation to the environment, frames self-other relations in a particular way. If the self internalizes all things, then the self can be the measure of all things. This idea goes back to Protagoras and the Greeks. It allows the individual to be viewed as some kind of decentered center of the cosmos. This relational conception of the body, of self,
individual and consequently of political identity, constitutes a rejection of the world view traditionally ascribed to Descartes, Newton and Locke. This view grounds the ideal of the civilized and individualized body constitutes as an entity in absolute space and time. Leonardo da Vinci. I would have something to say about this dermatology, this porosity of the interface, not only of this body that is out there absent, but of all bodies. The skin is the surface. The surface is a limitation of the body, and the limitation of the body is not part of that body, and the limitation of one body is that which begins another. That which is no part of any body is a thing of naught. A thing of naught is that which fills no space. This is Da Vinci talking about interfaces, right? Pico della Mirandola. In my cosmological system, man is also a decenter thing, a center that occupies no fixed space. Like my colleagues that Dave cited, I imagine the world as a closed cosmos, a finite space, well delimited and defined, where everything has its proper place, each thing in its natural site, every subject and object occupying the proper territory, eternally and according to God's will. No subject originally created by God appears to be capable of questioning the perfection of such a complete cosmos. But an ominous guest came to disturb this so harmonious plan. This guest is man. Assistant, would this cosmos in which each thing occupies a fixed, eternal place have anything to do with the social and political structure described and prescribed by Plato in his Republic? Pico della Mirandola, maybe. After all, I'm a Neoplatonist. But in my system, there is no original, nor definitive place for man. Whatever man place may be, he must conquer it. Man does not belong in the cosmos. He has no defined seat, no fixed shape, no specific function. Eccentric in relation to all things, man is completely foreign, a creature which appears to make no sense in the permanent order of creation. Precisely because he has no place, form, or function, he can choose to be, to look like, to do whatever he wants, according to his own will. Deprived of a fixed identity, freedom is the cipher of his essence. Like a chameleon, he changes skin. Man's entire vocation is permanent becoming and metamorphosis. Man always will be another. John is Johannes Kepler. This thinking carries with it I know not what secret horror. One finds oneself wandering in a great immensity devoid of any limit or center, and therefore of any determinate place. Leonardo, come on, John. You of all people, an astronomer, afraid of the infinite, nor there being no place nor sense? Well, which is the proposition which cannot be granted? And if granted, would have no sense. It's the infinite which thereby would become circumscribed and limited. For what the proposition assumes is of necessity bounded by something that surrounds it. And that which cannot be granted is that which has no limits. If you're still anxious about the lack of definitions, look into the air. The air is full of an infinite number of images of things which are distributed through it. And all of these are represented in all in one, and all in each. Pliny the Elder. That is basically how I see the sky. According to the etymology I propose in my natural history, the word would come from cello, from celato, meaning chisel, which again stresses the double meaning of mundus in Greek cosmos, both world and ornament. The sky is not smooth, polished like an egg, but is engraved with countless figures of all the animals and things, the seeds of which fall upon the earth or into the sea and give birth to beings. The eye can make out here the image of a bear, there one of a bull, elsewhere one of a letter. Leonardo, a beautiful way of seeing the world, no doubt, and I think that, in a way, it can be applied to painting. Painting is a way of seeing. He's not versatile, who does not love equally all things that are contained in painting. For example, if one does not like landscape, he steams in a matter of brief and simple investigation. As when our Botticelli said that such study was in vain, because by merely throwing a sponge full of diverse colors at a wall, it left a stain on that wall, where a fine landscape was seen. It is really true that various inventions are seen in such a stain. I say that a man should look into it and find heads of men, diverse animals, battles, rocks, seas, clouds, woods, and similar things, and note how like it is to the sound of bells, in which you can hear whatever you like. Knife thrower. This is curious because, in a way, this vision through approximation and deduction also applies to the techniques employed by a good knife thrower. Well, he is the bad knife thrower. The thrower should not aim at a whole area, but at one specific point, at an irregularity of the grain, in the grain of the wood, for example. Most likely, you would notice that your knives do not stick in the target point, but in a specific direction beside it. Now it is easy. Just move the point you're aiming at in your mind. Mark. Mark is Marcus Vitruvius, an architect. Things of the mind. But I think there are other things that a good knife thrower should know. For instance, that the measurements of the human body are distributed by nature as follows. That is, four fingers make one palm, four palms make one foot, six palms make one cubit, four cubits make a man's height, four cubits make one pace, and 24 palms make a man. If you open your legs so much as to decrease your height 1/14th and spread and raise your arms till your middle fingers touch the level of the top of your head, you must know that the center of the outspread limbs will be in the navel, and the space between the legs will be an equilateral triangle. Geber, the good knife thrower. Come on, Marcus, cut it out. You as an architect should know. It's not the thrower that counts, it's the target. Thank you.
Hello? Yes. Now we have the round table for this first day of this symposium. And I'd like to introduce Shutapa Biswas, artist that was born in India. She's a reader at the Chelsea College of Art and Design, University of the Arts London, and a core member of TRAIN. A monograph on her work has been published by INIVA and includes essays by Laura Mulvey, Guy Brett, Moira Roth, and Griselda Pollock. She has exhibited internationally, including recent shows at the Art Gallery of Ontario, Toronto in 2000, Andrew Rowe Gallery, Nottingham, 2004, and the Douglas F. Cooley Memorial Arts Gallery, Reed College, Portland, Oregon, 2006. Her work has also been included in numerous group exhibitions, including the Melbourne International Arts Festival in Australia, 2006, From Tarzan to Rambo, Tate Modern, London in 2002-2003, and the Havana Biennale, Cuba, 1997. I'd like to start with a question to Milton, because he finished his presentation, and then we had the break. And then if anyone of you would like also to address a question to him, and then we open after that the discussion. But Milton, your presentation was really interesting in the sense also that I think you changed it more or less the way the presentations were being conducted here, in the sense that you presented your artwork as the main topic from your speech. So somehow I think you inverted this topic of being influenced by the place that you mentioned that this is the main issue for the book. In the sense that as an artist, you are also concerned of producing places somehow, instead of being kind of just reacting to the place. So I'd like you to make some comments on that topic. Also, in the sense that as an artist, you have to find a way of organizing your work inside of the university, outside, in Brazil, in London, I mean, in this international scene and the local scene, but from the point of view of being an artist and producing your artwork and, let's say, producing some kind of place for you organize your own practice.
Well, actually, this work has been... Is it working? The first time I presented this work was in São Paulo in 2004. And I left London after 7 years living here in 2001. So it's a work that works like a transition in some way. And there's something about, you know, losing your own space. When I came to London, yeah, I kind of left my place in Brazil, kind of abandoned my place in Brazil, to occupy the whole world, yeah? So there's this option, this negotiation that you always have to do between the space you are dealing with, you're occupying, and the refusal of this space to you know, to receive you. I remember when I was doing my studies here that some of my supervisors complained that I was difficult to understand, and maybe the reason was that I was writing some kind of magic realism. And I said, yeah, I'm writing magic realism about Heidegger and Nietzsche, if you like. So there's a negotiation, really, between being there and not being there, which is what this work is about. Being the assistant to the main protagonist, who's Roger, yeah, I kind of open a space for myself as someone who is assisting, yeah, who is watching. And this has to do with this negotiation that I had to do. I came to London, and I saw myself and my family and my place and my work from afar, yeah? And now I'm going through a very interesting experience, because it's kind of the opposite, yeah? And I think, well, is London my place, yeah? Was it my place at some point? So, also, I think we are, I mean, we artists are, the construction we are making is producing discourse. Yeah. Of course, this has modulations as well. It's not discourse as a kind of a series of words, yes, but we are constructing discourses, yeah, even if you do a performance, a painting, whatever, because it's not, well, we know, we all know those. We're not working in the interiority heart, yeah? So when I say that the very extensive man is pure exteriority, I'm also referring to this always exterior part of the interior. Yeah, I don't know if this is the answer to your question, but
it was more a provocation for you to speak about these actions of intervening directly on a place where you can, from where you organize your practice. Mm-hmm.
Well, the other thing you asked, I remember now, is how to connect, if this is what you meant, my practice as an artist and my practice as a writer or a professor of art history. Well, lately I have been introducing myself not as an artist anymore. I prefer to say that I am a plastic, because we have, you know, plastic artist. Yeah. So I'm hesitating to define myself as an artist. This hesitation is ... plastic. Yeah. In Portuguese, it makes more sense. It's artista plástico. Yeah. So I am plástico, because, you know, it's not very easy for the market, for the circuit, to accommodate practices like, for example, the academic, into the production of discourse, because the market doesn't understand our production as the production of discourse, but it understands as the production of objects, of products. Yeah. So this is why I kind of abandoned this territory, defined very clearly. Yeah, this is the plastic art that you're producing, to produce another kind of discourse, something like this. So, you know, when I'm teaching, I'm doing artwork.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask Milton something?
It's a slightly naughty question. I just wanted to ask you about your one of your decisions. That, what was your thinking, or how did you weigh up the decision to have something as exciting as the knife thrower? An exciting activity brought into the gallery space, quite a difficult piece, quite a cerebral piece, but in a way the audience can be excited and emote to the spectacle of the circus, the spectacle of the street, the spectacle of the knife thrower, and the way how you decide which bit of it, you know, your choosing of that excitement makes it yours, or is it your collaborator? What was it? I can't remember his name.
Roger. Yeah, you know, this work was conceived in 1978. Yeah,
I have this drawing. It's an incomplete drawing. I never finished this drawing because it was very hard to finish because it's a watercolor. I think there's some crayon as well. But it's this image of a man built up by knives. Yeah. and when the first time I presented this work was a group show in São Paulo called Territories. And I said, well, what am I going to show? Then I decided to show this work. And people were very interested in knowing, what is Milton presenting? You know, he's coming back from London. I could not reveal, see, so I had to keep it secret. So every artist in the exhibition said, well, I'm going to produce this and that, I'm presenting this. And I said, well, I cannot say. So it created a kind of, you know, a very tense... expectation, yeah. But I incorporated this kind of tension into the work. Because if I revealed anything, like, for example, the phrase, yeah, I would say what the work is. So people only realized what was going on when it was going on, yeah? Yeah, it's something that... the second time I presented the work, some people knew, yeah, what was going to happen. But it was completely different. Like here, for example, when he was very nervous, more than myself, because he, well, you know, Tomio Taki Institute in São Paulo, it's very chic, and he was very nervous. And in Rio, he made a calculation of how many meters he would be far from the wall. It was like 2 meters. And he was so nervous, he gave one step ahead. That's why the knives don't go like this, perpendicular to the wall, and they go like this. A reason for not throwing 100 knives and 66 instead. But all these accidents are incorporated by in the work, you see. Is that what you asked?
Well, it's interesting.
And the reason I decided to, you know, to bring this is because we are discussing place. We have this question, which is weird, because I think I'm the only one who brought the question to the book and to this discussion here. You didn't know?
No. Moisir deals with place. Many people deal with place, not perhaps.
Yeah, because I emphasized the question, yeah? Because there's a tendency in all this conversation. Well, by the way, these things that I read, they're really quotes, yeah? These people really said those things. I'm quoting them, yeah? And the tendency in this discussion is to, okay, place is very important. It's absolutely crucial to be in its proper place, yes? But there's something which comes before, which is the universal, the humane, yeah? And that's, Pico de Mirandola has such an important contribution to make, yeah? Yeah, well, there was an audience, yeah? And besides the audience, there was a team of, you know, people with cameras, and so there was a whole production. It was very tense, really. I don't know if you noticed, the first throw, he missed. The second was okay. The third was a miss as well. So he missed many times because of this problem with the distance, yes? So people thought that this was planned, you know, that all these accidents were part of the work. And of course, not knowing what was going to happen, people were asking me, are you being there? Are you the model? I said, well, I don't know what will happen, because they were, you know, concerned about my safety. But it was a very tense situation, really. The noise that I eliminated here, for obvious reasons, was very strong as well. Yeah.
What about the violence?
The violence.
What about the violence? There's violence there. It's a person, and it's you actually stabbing your own self, practically.
Yeah, just let me, because I think this piece has... it's a very fast comment, but I think it's so interesting how you organize the work in this dichotomic way. Mm-hmm. Like, you write something, you are outside of the writing, the other line is just a line profile of a body.
Yeah.
Both have lines, so the writing and the drawing. So it's like playing with two different situations of the, let's say, this mind and body problem, really clearly defined, but in the way you try to mix. And this violence, at the same time, somehow there is a sort of healing in this process, because these knives also can be sort of needles in your body, yeah, trying to heal, or this kind of therapy or acupuncture. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to bring the completely extremes into a sort of, into their opposite, mm-hmm, somehow.
Yeah, so. I don't see any violence in that, because
very violent, because to yourself, it's that man is that he was there and his image is still there and he's actually stabbing himself.
It's his image that's there.
His image is still partly there, and so it's called self-harming.
That's the very extensive man. That's not his image. That's the image of the very extensive man.
It's like his shadow of himself.
Because, well, it doesn't show here, because it was a decision I took during the performance. Before I do the performance, I write skin all over the place, the gallery or the museum, whatever. And I this was a decision I took here. I write... Maybe you notice that I go into a kind of ladder and I write something on the wall. It's skin. So the very extensive man is perfectly safe because he's not there. Yeah, that's the only space that he doesn't occupy.
Leonardo.
Hmm?
Leonardo.
Exactly. So of course there's a violence because you're throwing knives at something. Yeah, but what about the violence in the circus, for example?
It's that, but it's something. It's like a trace of where he has been. So sure. It is a way of self-harming. It, you know, it can be translated like that.
Mm. I think the violence has to do with abandonment, with, you know, the loss of place. The loss, it's more metaphorical. It's not, nobody can be hurt in this situation.
I think that's violent up to the point that you finished writing the sentence. Then people can realize that place is the only safe place to be.
Yeah.
I think that's violent up to a point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it has some kind of parallel with Manzoni's plinth upside down.
Oh yeah.
Where the plinth is holding the world.
Exactly.
There is a similar idea of everything except for the actual object.
Mm-hmm.
And that's.
Yeah, it has to do with perplexity. See, that's very violent. If you remember, at some point, the assistant, I mean, David Harvey, who is the geographer, yeah, says to the assistant, who is myself, as you said before, something I wrote somewhere, that the only certainty we have today is that we are perplexed. Yeah? If you have A and B, you're not supposed to get to C. You don't have this teleology, and this is very violent. Yeah? But this is in Republics, in Plato's cave already, this kind of loss. This is very violent. But it's metaphorical, of course. So I think this has to do with this perplexity, which is really very violent.
Not meaning deliberately to bring it back to my own paper, but by accident. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of similarities in some of the things I was trying to talk about in relation to Netto and the Enlightenment,
mm-hmm,
and the Leviathan Thought piece to the Pantheon, and the way in which the notion of mathematics, calculation, mm-hmm, organization, how that fits with some sense of chance and the, mm-hmm, organic, that even though they're so different, there's some relationship to how you talk about the past, how you deal with these intellectual constructs of freedom and oppression, mm-hmm, how one approaches the Enlightenment, or in your case, the Renaissance, as a contemporary practitioner. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'm stretching it a bit. But with Netto, I can stretch, can't
you're
I?
It's like expensive. Yes. You're a very extensive woman.
Could I make a quick comment? I think in the same way that it has this connection with Oriana's paper, it also has a connection with Moisir's paper, in that Manepi's work is about a place, yet that place is empty of the work. The work doesn't belong there.
Yeah.
So that there is a kind of ambivalence towards...
But maybe this is an illusion. I think, in which way you think Marepi's work could belong to his place? Which place? What place?
Well, that was the argument that Moisi was making. Although I have some disagreements in terms of... I think in 1993, I went to Cachoeira, which is in the Recôncavo Baiano, which is the region where Marepe's town is located. And there was a biennial of contemporary art, the Bienal de Recôncavo, and I think it was the second edition at the time. And the first edition, Marepe had won the main prize. So perhaps not in his own town, but certainly in the immediate region, he is recognized as a contemporary artist.
He is recognized by the critics and the jury of this biennial. It's not from, even from Bahia, it's from São Paulo and Rio. But I think that the main point is not the recognition or not of his work there, but the fact that his work is about a place, but it's about Santo Antônio de Jesus, that's his hometown, but in the sense that Santo Antônio de Jesus is a sort of symbol of a place which is in transit, in permanent transit. It's there, but also not there at the same time. You cannot approach it as a place, as a physical place, a physical territory, but as a sort of a metaphor for this displacement that we all live nowadays. I think that's the main point.
Yeah. I'd actually just like to shift this discussion a little bit because we have some new panelists on our panel, and I'd like to just ask Shutapa about, I mean, it seems to me a question of, this is convened around a question of place, of location, of displaced places and locations, and the cultural flows that might go through different places, and whether place is important to your work. Do you see your work in relation to particular spatial references or places, or do you think that's an important constituent of the work that you've been making recently? I think it would be quite interesting to draw that into a kind of contemporary practice debate. Yes, and in case you haven't seen, standing up here on the lectern here is the cover of Art and Essays, which is published in relation to this conference, and Shutapa's work is on the cover, so you can all see some recent work by Shutapa at the moment. But I think it would just be interesting to see whether that's part of, whether you think that's part of the debate in your own work.
I think that for me, on a personal level, you know, things keep shifting. So I was, for example, very interested in your references in their house, in elaborating a sense of curative memory and how that's something that is very difficult to rid of somehow. It becomes very much part of your being in that sense. And for me, I've been very interested also in hearing about Marepe and also Milton's work, and amongst other works, to see and to consider the extent to which I think that being an artist, for me at any rate, I belong both in my garden, which is a very, very private space, actually, and in a place that's out there. So I'm quite interested in the local and the global. And I think that there is a kind of rupture that takes place in moving, you know, from that position, you know, within your immediate surrounding to a place which you sort of see slightly further afield. And then within that, of course, you belong to something which is much, much more of a wholeness. So when, in reference to the discussion about violence, I think also thinking about Marepe's work or Félix González Torres's work or Amalia Mesa-Baines, for example, there is an extraordinary sensibility, I think, which happens that I'm observing in terms of, you know, belonging to something which is not necessarily, you know, I don't know what authenticity is, for example, either. And, you know, I've said this before, I feel very English, not even British, I feel very English when I'm abroad, except maybe in India, where I feel average height, you know, and not tiny, you know. So, you know, so I think that all those things just keep shifting for me. But I am, I'm very curious about this debate, and I'm interested in Marepe, maybe because, you know, I'm trying to get inside his head, really, and trying to understand what makes an artist want to occupy that kind of place, that sense of being, to an extent, incognito, you know, belonging to something secretly, and, you know, moving a little bit like a flaneur without necessarily being seen or noticed. But that does not mean that you don't absorb or reflect or engage. And so I think that maybe answers your question, but I am interested. And perhaps I'd like to go back to the Isabel's talk again, and also your own, with reference to the idea of, I'm still trying to work out exactly this argument about language and being, you know, being outside of language and the kind of constraints of philosophical conditions, if that makes sense. And for me, that's interesting, because I think that as an artist, that's the space I occupy. And I don't think that language or philosophy belongs to any one culture, really, or place. I think it belongs in a book.
And in my head.
Yes. Can I ask something to Isabel?
Isabel. Yes.
Sorry.
I'd like to.
You have a question for me?
Yes. Oh. But you want to say something?
No.
We have, it's about the monotypias by Miriam Schendel. A great number of them have writing, some sort of writing, but which is a writing which never fully established in the field of writing. Something that's announced itself as writing, but never fully established as such. And I wonder if it would be possible to relate it to, for example, Samuel Beckett's work, which was sometimes I feel that Mir Schendel's monotype has that feeling, that the feeling of something that never fully managed to express itself as such. And I think that is a trace of Beckett's work as well. I don't know if it makes sense for you.
No, it does. I think it... I always assumed that she was deliberately not reaching that, which you would say of Beckett as well, I think, deliberately failing. I don't know what more I can say about that, apart from that I agree with you. And that perhaps that says something about, you know, her formation as an artist, that you can make these relationships, that you... I mean, this is interesting about her work. You see her work and you think of someone else. You think of a writer, you think of a playwright. I mean, this is something that I think is very particular to her work. And I don't know whether it's because it deals with language.
Your research, you didn't find any...
Oh, did I actually find any...
Any...
To Beckett?
Yeah, any relation, any...
No, mention. No hard evidence, no. I think that... her common lineage was very kind of connected to German writing, but plus things that she encountered in Brazil, but I haven't ever come across any reference, but I think it's always possible with her.
Okay.
I'd like to ask a question to Carlo Zilio about his own experience as an academic researcher in Paris, writing about the issue of national identity in Brazilian modern art, which I believe your PhD was about. At least the books you published following that were about. I'm just wondering whether that was a choice, something that you felt was important at that moment, and we're talking about the 1970s, so the debate has evolved considerably since, or whether it was something that was expected of you.
No, at that time, I think it was something that was important for my generation to think about. It was a heritage that we just received, and it was something that until that moment, as I think nobody thought about it in an academic way, let's say. And as I was living in Paris, you know, at that time Paris was very far away from Brazil. Had on the telephone that you could, you know, get in touch. So that the paradox is that keeps you closer to your country. So I just began by chance, I know, to think about, but no. At the beginning, it was just an article, but as time passes, went by, well, it became bigger and bigger. That's it.
Any questions from the audience? Yes.
I just sort of wanted to ask, because it's one thing that hadn't been touched on really, was the idea of those who haven't got a national identity in terms of being in asylum, being in that kind of political situation where, and I was trying myself to think of artists who displayed that kind of identity. The only thing I could think of was a film piece. I can't for the life of me remember who it's by, but it was called Asylum. It's big, with big screens of people doing menial jobs. I'm sorry, help me out here. No, anyway. But I just sort of wanted to throw that into the mix and see if you could give me any ideas of how that would fit with this issue of transcending identity and things.
I think that's a really interesting question. It takes me back to a question earlier today where someone was talking about the relationship between stereotypes of culture and stereotypes of class. And I think you've touched upon an even greater complexity, which is the way in which we address the notion of the political in relation to the transnational. I don't really have any clear examples or answers, but I do think it's something that is a very important aspect of how one has to approach looking at a work, and not an easy assumption of nationhood. And I think part of the transnational is a sense of recognizing a notion of both statelessness and a kind of fluidity. I mean, the kind of ebb and flow issue that Deborah was talking about. I don't know if you want to.
I think it's a really, really important issue, because also quite often you can be of one nationality but not living in that place. I spend half my week in Europe, so there are all sorts of questions, not only about statelessness, but where does your nationality take you, and how does it change when you live in a different country or when you visit that other country? So nationality might not be quite so stable. Was it Dirty Pretty Things you were thinking about? I don't know. Was it an art piece or a film? I wasn't sure.
It was an art piece.
Right. But I think it's a question that's at the heart of the transnational. The question of statelessness is really important, I think. And the questions of how you exist as a stateless subject is one that we need to think about in this context.
I mean, I made a film piece myself sort of a few years ago after I was stuck in a corridor in Lithuania airport after not being allowed in because my passport had expired. And I was stuck there for 16 hours. And it made me think an awful lot about how being in that limbo, that the sort of analogies with being in purgatory and being of no place and of time just ticking through. And it's just sort of, I don't know, that was quite interesting.
I think what you're talking about is absolutely central, and maybe earlier on I wasn't clear enough about saying that the distinction I would make between something like the international, which is still a useful word, and the transnational, is the transnational allows for the concept of statelessness, and it allows for the idea of something which isn't a debate between two nations, but is some kind of movement, possibly a limbo, between one nation and another, or even the notion of a nation itself.
I'd just like to add that the sense of belonging is, I think that from what I understood, that to the question about how the sense of belonging is embedded with the political as well. And so I remember that when Sildo Meirelles and Edward Seeker were invited to the Exhibition Information, the exhibition in 1997 in MoMA, New York, and they stated in the catalog that they were not there represented any country. Because at that moment, Brazil were under dictatorship. So that was a very clear statement about nationality, about belonging, saying that their nationality depended also on political states of the country at that moment.
Yeah, also, Fernando Pessoa, you know, the Portuguese poet, wrote that my language is my country. And Caetano Veloso repeats this sentence. And Ricardo remembers in 1994, we were San Sebastian, Spain, which is a Basque country. Yeah? And it was a very interesting week or month. We spent 1 month there working. Because it was the commemoration of 100 years of the Ikurriña, which is the Basque flag. It's not a national flag, you see, because this country, this nation, is defined by language. So it's part France, part Spain. And the interesting thing is that the ETA, which is a kind of specific Basque issue, they used very huge scissors to cut everything that, because in Spain, in the Basque country, you have both Castellano, or Spanish, and Basque words, like bus stop in both languages. So San Sebastian is Donostia. So if you approach the city by car, for example, or by bus, you wouldn't see San Sebastian because they cut it out. Yeah, they eliminated all the words that refer to everything, bus stop, eat well, do this, do that, in Spanish, so that only Basque language was left. It was like a void that suddenly was. Remember that. And I really felt the strength of this country defined by language. And only 20% of the people in the Basque country, especially Spain, speak Basque, which is kind of schizophrenic, yeah? Because it's a country defined by a language that people don't speak.
The Basque language, no one knows where it comes from.
Sorry?
Exactly.
Yeah, and also they're like 28 declinations. It's a very complex language. You're absolutely right. Yeah, nobody knows where this comes from.
And there is a question there. She was waiting for the microphone.
Oriana mentioned earlier that non-Western artists often find that they're that their audiences define their readings of their work by certain preconceptions they have of their nationalities. And I was just wondering, and this is a question for all of you, if you feel that British artists abroad are defined by any similar sets of preconceptions, or they come with the advantage or disadvantage of kind of clean slate. I was just wondering how you felt in that regard.
Can I just briefly say one very relevant answer to that? Once I attended a paper by the marketing manager of British Airways, and it was absolutely galvanic, because British Airways keeps the entire word British Airways, because being British is part of the brand image, right? And then obviously the sort of advertisement in different countries, at TVs and so on, they emphasize the British. But what he said, what the Japanese think British is completely different from what the Americans think British, right? So even the British, even if you go as a British somewhere else, what the local thinks you are British is probably completely different from what you think a British. So even the nationality is not a single concept. It's myriad different kind of things.
I was just about to say that, you know, it's a very soiled slate. So in other words, you know, it has many marks on it. And I think that that's what is interesting. Going back to the question about, you know, a sense of what identity means in any context, you know, my father left India because of his sort of political involvement, and having sort of been an academic in sort of post-partition years, he was never willing to accept the way in which the British were involved in the you know, instigation of partition, if you like, or the implementation of partition. So it's a very complex you know, equation, and I think that there is no single, you know, answer or single picture. I think that what's interesting is how, as an artist or as a creative individual, you can unpick, you know, the language that exists around it. And in India, in particular, for example, that relationship to between England or Britain and India is a highly charged one, but and very, very complex. But with time, even over a 30-year period, it's shifted so much. You know, it's a very enmeshed relationship, and that in itself, historically, is different in terms of the relationship between, you know, the British Empire and other parts of their kind of colonial sort of rule, if you like. So I don't think, given that it can ever be, there can ever be one answer to that.
Are you saying that British art carries a colonial history?
Does British art carry, you mean in general?
Yes.
Well, of course it does, yes. But, you know, if you want to see it, is it entirely negative because of that? You know, I mean, we've been talking about the legacy of modernist, you know, art historical readings all day, actually. And I think that, you know, the exhibition here of Otikika's work also engages with those kinds of complex issues and concerns. And yeah, you can't undo what has been done. You read it, and, you know, I think that all of the speakers today on some level have addressed different aspects of, you know, the way in which global economies and power structures function. And, you know, that has a violence to it, both in terms of subjectivities and how one, you know, explores and describes and makes work about that. Milton's work, you know, being a very good case of, you know, the dealing with the subject, you know, his subjectivity in the context of, you know, being a student at Goldsmiths, etc., etc. You know, I think that it carries baggage. You know, we all do.
Some people might not come from anywhere. I mean, I know lots of European people who don't come from anywhere. For instance, I'm Russian, I'm Basque, I was born in Yugoslavia. You know, some people don't come from anywhere. I mean, they don't identify deeply with anything.
And maybe you're one of these cumulative people that Deborah talked about.
You see what I'm saying? Some people don't come from any particular, or don't do allegiance to being British or colonialism, or, you know, they just come with themselves at the end.
Oui.
I think that's,
and some European, it hasn't happened so much here, but here it is happening more. Like we're getting a huge amount of refugees and Yugoslavians and Slovaks and Russians and everyone who is going to become British sooner or later, I suppose. And so, you know, you carry the British from all, as you said, from all different, like Indian British or, you know, Chinese British. I think you can become British, and especially now, I think that our society is more and more.
We have three questions. One, two, three.
One of the questions, I'm not an expert in any way, but there feels to me that there might be a bit of an exclusion here in terms of, I was very interested, Manet's letter mentioned that all you could see on the street were the slaves. And in your piece, you have a black man who you say you're assisting, but it felt very much as if you were very much in control of what was actually happening in terms of you having the drawing or the artist's equipment, you stopping, deciding when to stop. You seem very much in control. And it feels slightly as if there's a voice, and an African voice, that has been left out in terms of representation of art. And I'm just very interested in the fact that the word race doesn't seem to have been mentioned at all. When we're kind of here, we're brought here together by almost the excuse for being here is a piece of work or a collection called The Body of Colour, which seems like a very specific title. So I'm just very interested in that and the fact, you know, we can see from the round table that there's an exclusion.
Can I answer?
Yes.
I just say that in the case of Marep, Marep is a mulatto. It's from Bahia, but the race is not an issue in his work. Maybe because it's embedded in all what he does. He speaks from a place from which he also implies, in his case, a race. Bahia is a very African. The African heritage in Bahia is very clear, but it's not an issue in his work. Although it's evidently it's present all the time, but it's not a.
And just a short, very short comment. But obviously, the political lines don't match the cultural lines. And if we speak about Brazilian culture, for sure we have to include African culture. Of course, it's really a big, strong element of. So, even if it's not so direct here, I think. Through this Brazilian issue of the discussion, for sure, if we had more time, maybe it would become clear, maybe more of this confluence of cultures, for sure.
And I think it was very much at the base of what I was trying to talk about in relation to cultural stereotype and notions of authenticity, that race was central to that, and one of the issues around the work by Amalia Meza-Baines was very much to do with the use of the Virgin of Guadalupe as a symbol of a mixed race image. But I understand some. I see what you're meaning in other senses about more direct issues around Brazilian culture. But I do think that theoretically, issues of race have underpinned several of the papers.
I was just going to say, absolutely. You know, I think it's very. For me, it's absolutely key to most of the, well, pretty much all of the discussions that, or papers that have been presented. And very, very much, you know, it's very much the rationale for artists like myself to engage with particular kinds of themes. The image on the front cover of the book, for example, A&E, Essays and Art and Essays, as opposed to Accident and Emergencies.
It was a series of accidents.
You know, it comes from the English heritage swatch colours, you know, and so the indicators, you know, the references to particular kinds of histories, you know, are very much present within that piece. And its final realization, which references the work of George Stubbs, in which he paints an image of, you know, the aristocracy at play, whilst a black male servant is tending to their horses. I think that it's been very, very central to issues around transcultural discourses.
We have, our time is really short now, and we have two more questions, you and her in the back.
I was asking something that she was talking about, the thing, that culture that she was with. Her visa exported and this kind of thing, and I just remember, and everybody was saying some keywords as space, borderline, and this kind of issues. And in Brazil, I went to a symposium in SESC, about another concept that here is treated like transnational, and they were talking about a concept that. All the speaker was using the same keywords that you guys are using, but the concept that they were talking is interterritorial in part. I don't know if in English is the same translation, but means that that space without borderline, that every culture is at the same, and they related this to the virtual environment and all the digital and technology kind of art productions. And here, as Milton, isn't it? He said that you are a plastic artist, and me as a technologic artist, I'm asking you what kind of issues the transnational concept is related to this interterritorial concept in this new technology art production that we are notice here. Nowadays.
Well, if it's, to me, I mean, I think this attempt to call it transnational is the agony of not having the globe anymore in our hands, yeah? Because the thing about globalization is that we don't have the globe anymore, yeah? Once you are in a spaceship and you see the globe over there, you see, you lose the world, right? You don't have the globe anymore. So we are always inventing these categories to deal with this loss of territory. We need these borders, we need maps, we need representations of the very extensive world, you see. So I think it's a strategy to deal with the impossibility of, you know, saying this is Brazil, this is Africa, this is black, this is Basque, you know. So I accept the provocation of the word transnational, but it is a problem for us. For example, when these people came to Brazil in Rio, the first thing we asked them, what do you mean about transnational? Because Brazil is totally transnational, you see, all the time. You see, it's with us, it's us. We are transnational. What are we? Indians, black, Portuguese, French, Italians. We are all these things at the same time, you see. So the transnational issue is, you could say, let's call it Brazilian, for example.
Just a moment. I think that's an important issue here.
But what I was talking about is that non-cultural and non-space that the virtual environment gives to us. You know, I don't have culture there. I'm like a zero and one, you know. I don't have color there.
Yeah, because it's important to say that the interterritorial, transnational, doesn't mean that you live in, you don't have any more frontiers, any more barriers, as the world was liquid, a liquid space. There's no such liquidity around the globe. For a person who lives in Africa and wants to come to Europe, there are frontiers. For those Mexicans who want to cross the barriers and go to the United States, the world is not liquid. There are barriers, there are frontiers. So the transnational then is also have to think in relative ways.
It's a methodology, you know, that we people here share.
It reminds me of when I saw Guillermo Gomez Peña, who I showed you a slide of, when he was asked about whether he'd sold out because he left. He'd been working the border workshop between Mexico and the United States, and he got this big prize and went to New York. And they said, you know, why are you giving up on dealing with this issue of borders? He said, well, there are far more borders in New York than there ever are between Mexico and United States. And I think that is one of those issues that we've been skirting around about class and race and the kind of worlds within worlds that we inhabit, whether it's in the virtual space or in defined national territories. I think it's a very interesting issue that one has to...
We have one last question that...
One point, because I want to go back to what the question was about the question of race, and I think that's an important question. And if we track back a little bit in the conversation to the question of colonial legacy, one of the things that was very present for European nations was definitions of race in the making of colonialism. And maybe this whole question now about thinking about the transnational, what is it beyond the national boundary? This whole question that you asked of race is really important, but it's one of the questions I think that does gets a little bit submerged in questions about the transnational. And I think the transnational has to rethink the question about the legacy of the national. And I think that maybe thought a bit about it before I came back to thinking, and I think you're absolutely right that maybe this question of race does need to be back on the table, but rethought in terms of a transnational framework. And I don't know that, you know, it's been there today, but maybe there's more to be done and more to be thought about and maybe more to be kind of engaged with tomorrow. But it's a really important question, and I just wanted to say that I thought we should kind of really think that, not think that we did it today, but you know, we're not going to find an easy answer, but it just needs to be constantly, you know, we need to be thinking about it. And to just thank you for that question.
Could I just quickly throw in something, because before it's missed, because there was an issue that I don't have
any culture when I'm on the, I'm zeros and one, in front of the computer or something. So it's not about that there's no borderline or the fluidity of borderlines or so on in virtual space, but I think that's an issue that has not been addressed and that is on the verge of slipping out. I don't have a culture in the virtual space. That's, I mean, I can't quite get my head around this. I don't know whether it's right, but it's a very valid question, and I'm wondering whether we it's getting lost.
Yeah, I just, what if this, sorry, just for that last very quick.
Okay, she has a question there.
I have a question to Carlos, especially. I'm sorry if it's, it might be a bit tricky, but anyway, that the first of all, thank you very much for the fascinating presentations by all of you. But I have kind of feeling that, that there is different issue between the kind of stateless or nationless and transnationalism. I think this that is a very different issue to discuss about. And I cannot help but feeling kind of uncomfortability here because somehow that this sort of stateless and nationless can be fantasized too much glorification here in this symposium. And as far as I understand, Carlos was wounded and imprisoned during the dictatorship in Brazil. So in a way, you became...
That was a long time ago.
Long time ago. But in a way, I just wanted to sort of dig out the kind of moment. I presume that my imagination, but you became kind of stateless or nationless in your own nation, in a way. Yeah. And how do you comment this kind of sort of glorification of stateless or nationless, because I think it's not so easy to mention in many ways.
Well, you know, as time passes by, it becomes a little bit, how could I say, ironic to talk about that because it's so far away, so I don't know. Also, the problem with the, my English. Anyway, being the question is being Brazil, but not being there. Will, is that it?
So that because I feel kids are there somehow. This kind of stateless, nationless, become the kind of chant of the glorification of the transculturalism, which I think is not so, it's a bit problematic. And because you experienced kind of be a refugee or a person who dislocated in your own state under dictatorship, so you might have some comment of this kind of glorification of the notion.
You know, it's very interesting for me to hear about all these lectures because, as Milton has said, for us it was something new when this term transnational came to us in our last meeting in Brazil. In Rio.
Snitch you got.
I think the stateless and the nationless is two different things.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's a matter of belonging. So
how you feel you belong to, and in one way you can belong to lots of things. But yeah, you are saying that also transnationalism is not necessarily, I mean, I don't say transnationalism, but transnational issues are not necessarily about glorification of statelessness or sort of if you don't have any nations you belong to, that's sort of great. I don't think it's that simple.
I understand, but somehow I feel some people accept this.
Could I say something?
I wanted to say that I really, really agree with you, and I think it's a problem when any of us who don't haven't experienced it talk about artists who have. And obviously, I mean, talking about the writing of Willem Flusser, and also the work of Mary Shendel, there is this sort of tendency to glorify their biography. But it is a fact, nonetheless, that they themselves did come to that conclusion, that they had to make a decision to turn what was a very negative situation into a positive one. So I agree that it is a real, it's a risk and it's a danger to glorify these things, but you also have to acknowledge that some artists have been through this experience and they have arrived at, well, they've said that they've arrived at a kind of positive interpretation of it, but I think that's a really important issue that I hope we can carry on talking about tomorrow, because I think we've reached the end.
And it's clear that this condition of transnationality here, it's just a kind of exercise on methodology that it's building something. I mean, there is no such a place, but everybody's involved in some kind of practice that is trying to escape for certain closures, and this is a name that is operational in this moment. And I think it's very interesting that this methodology that is being named kind of transnational or something somehow puts together as well researchers from different kinds. So an artist research or even the methodology of art historian or art critic needs to be rethought somehow, is shaken because of this provocation. So maybe what you feel as so positive is this kind of common effort of reaching another place through some kind of devices. And if we, there is the feeling that if a moment after we just return to our countries and then this disappears, so it's kind of this common work, no? But I was told that the time is over, and then it continues tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Okay. Galo cantou.